Coming up on Fronteras, a lack of family doctors. That problem is felt most acutely in rural regions.
Most of the time, these medical students and residents love our patients. They love the area. It may be the first time they even consider rural medicine. And if you can just get them here, I think you've got a great chance of recruiting them back.
Hear about a first-of-its-kind medical residency program on the U.S.-Mexico border. On Fronteras, we've been looking at the future of solar power in Texas. Despite obstacles, solar's gaining ground around some parts of the state.
In Texas, there are local utilities, for example, CPS in San Antonio, Austin Energy in Austin, that have provided local rebates that have helped solar.
Solar is making inroads in Texas, albeit slowly. Those stories, but first, the news. It's time for Fronteras, the journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border area, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. Solar energy advocates and state regulators appear to be split on just how much help to give this growing industry. As it stands, there aren't any state mandates specifically for solar production, and the head of the Public Utilities Commission says Congress should end solar's 30% federal tax credit. Despite that landscape, solar is breaking through in parts of Texas. As part of Marfa Public Radio's look at solar's future in Texas, Lauren Madelon reports the industry is providing models that renewable energy advocates hope will resonate across the state, starting with the price of solar power.
When you buy gas, it's by the gallon. When you buy electricity, it's by the kilowatt hour, meaning 1,000 watts used over the course of an hour. A typical U.S. home uses 900 kilowatt hours a month. The average cost of a kilowatt hour in Texas is about 10 cents, nationally 12 cents. Well, the city of Austin is building a solar farm that will deliver at less than 5 cents a kilowatt hour. Money talks, and that's a loud voice.
These technologies are disruptive.
Larry Perea installs solar in New Mexico and Texas. Solar is disruptive. In 2012, Congress killed a policy that allowed installers to get cash back instead of a future tax credit. Despite that, solar installations increased by more than 100% last year.
You know, when new technology comes in, it displaces other people at work. The coal industry, for example, they're going to get displaced. Farmhands got displaced with mechanizing agricultural equipment.
In Texas, solar is slowly making inroads. A number of Texas counties have offered solar companies tax breaks and the open space needed for industrial-scale solar farms. Recurrent Energy of San Francisco's building in West Texas, and it signed a 20-year deal to sell solar to Austin Energy. First Solar of Arizona, one of the world's largest solar companies, is building near Fort Stockton.
I think the utility scale is coming around very quickly.
Varun Rai examines the intersection of policy and the energy markets at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT Austin. He says those companies are coming to Texas to make deals with utilities that like solar, despite the lack of state support for the technology.
In Texas, there are local utilities, for example, CPS in San Antonio, Austin Energy in Austin, that have provided local rebates that have helped the solar.
There's still a major stumbling block in Texas. Electricity made with solar is taken off a customer's monthly bill. But utilities say that pushes up the cost of energy for customers who don't have solar. How so? Well, when we buy power, we pay for two things, the electricity and the cost of maintaining the power lines that bring it to us. Solar customers pay much less for electricity because they generate it. That means the utility has less money for maintenance.
When you look at Texas, it doesn't matter what happens at the Capitol. The market is on a path to deciding this all by itself.
Brewster McCracken runs Pecan Street in Austin. Among other projects, it focuses on renewables like solar. And even he empathizes with the utilities on this.
They have no real way to monetize that electricity. It becomes a situation where the utility is having to have all the same costs virtually to serve a home with solar panels, but their revenue can go down 60 to 100%. And in some cases, they're actually paying their customers for electricity, even though the utility and the other customers of the utility aren't realizing any quantifiable benefit from it.
Again, Larry Perea, the solar installer, he says utilities can make money with renewables, but he says the examples of Austin and San Antonio are few and far between.
If the homeowner is able to pocket the money by producing their own electricity, well, then that's revenue and that's not going to a regulated monopoly. And I believe utilities recognize that there's a legitimate threat to their business model that they've been using, you know, for the last 100 years.
That said, private power companies just love Texas. The mix of geography and a pro-business regulatory environment is highly attractive. One executive says oil and gas may boom and bust, but solar in Texas is reliable. Varun Rai from UT Austin, well, he says the die has been cast.
Incentives or not, we will over time, not just in Texas, but throughout the U.S. and increasingly across the world, we are seeing more and more solar diffusion because it is getting more competitive.
Then there's the state's rapid growth. It's a place with mounting demand for electricity. The falling price of installing solar makes it more of a realistic alternative to traditional energy sources. I'm Lorne Matalon in Marfa.
There's a crisis in the nation's healthcare system. A lack of doctors is a problem throughout the U.S., but it is felt most acutely in rural regions. Now, a possible solution to make up this deficit has made its way to the Texas-Mexico border for the first time. Paige Phelps of Marfa Public Radio reports.
I'm Marcus Welby.
Steve Kiley.
Did you ever consider general practice?
Yeah, I've considered it. I've also considered breaking my leg in three places and joining the Foreign Legion.
In 1969, America loved their TV show, Marcus Welby, M.D., partly as a reaction to the reality that medical students were turning away from general practice and family medicine for higher profile and higher paying specialties. In fact, since the late 60s, there's been an over 50% decline in students going the family medicine route. Nowhere has this felt with more impact than rural America, where access to care has always been an issue. That's where rural medical residencies hope to pick up the slack.
I am Adrian Billings, Chief Medical Officer of Presidio County Health Services. Most of the time, these medical students and residents love our patients. They love the area. It may be the first time they even consider rural medicine. And if you can just get them here, I think you've got a great chance of recruiting them back.
Billings is correct. Medical students, it turns out, tend to practice within 100 miles of where they do their residency. Research shows that a student who is exposed to a rural setting is more likely to go back. This is why Billings worked with Texas Tech Health Sciences Center Permian Basin to start a rural training track for medical residents. It started July 1st. Med student Casey Sharp is a perfect example. At UT Galveston, Sharp considered a career in urban ER, but decided to try rural medicine in Alpine and Marfa with Billings.
In comparison to the city, my interactions with patients there, they felt more authentic. The expectations of me were different and more realistic. It's nice to feel like it's appreciated. And I just sense that appreciation so much more deeply out there.
Doctors who practice in underserved areas qualify for state and federal loan forgiveness programs. The town of Presidio, for example, is one of the most underserved areas in the country, with a population of 7,000 and no full-time physician.
We are basing it off of the other rural family medicine residency programs that exist in the country, and there are not very many, and this will be the only one that's on the U.S.-Mexico border, and it'll be one of the more rural and more isolated residency programs that exists out there, so we'll be somewhat unique.
Mike Ellis, CEO of Big Bend Regional Medical Center, definitely agrees with that sentiment.
There are vast differences in what you would consider rural. We are considered frontier. Seriously, there is that designation of frontier. And we are a frontier hospital, but no legislation ever looks at a frontier institution. There's so few of us.
The point? The more remote, the harder it is to fund these types of programs. Dr. Randall Longenecker knows this firsthand. He opened a rural training track in 1998 and saw it close in 2011.
The funding for residency training traditionally goes through large teaching hospitals, and rural training tracks are appended to a larger program. When only two residents a year are going to a rural training site and there are 600 residents at the mothership, you can imagine what takes priority.
Big Bend Regional CEO Mike Ellis is considering adding a rural training track to his hospital. It would open in July 2015, if he can make it fit with his bottom line. Talks with Texas Tech Permian Basin continue. Meanwhile, studies show that students who choose rural residencies stay rural. Residents like Casey, the young physician.
I mean, I'm committing myself to a certain kind of life when I make this decision. But I think I'm there. I think I'm so ready to leave the city behind and just get into that zone.
Which means that residents of underserved areas have just a little more hope for their healthcare future. For Marfa Public Radio, I'm Paige Phelps.
It's nice to have you along for Fronteras. We'll be right back with more news from across the Southwest. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. The Southern California city of Escondido has reaffirmed its opposition to allowing a shelter for migrant children in the country illegally to open there. The commission heard some 2 hours of testimony from pro-immigrant activists who hope to change the commission's decision. Fronteras reporter Jill Replegal says the crowd at the hearing was very different during the city's first hearing on the shelter.
This was the reaction a month ago after the Escondido Planning Commission voted unanimously not to allow the federal government to open a shelter for immigrant youth in the city. Around 500 people packed the city council chambers and hallways for that meeting. Most people who spoke were against the shelter, and many made it clear that their opposition was more broadly aimed at what they said were lax federal immigration policies. But some local church and Latino groups, along with the ACLU, wanted to show the other side of the debate.
We all have different points of view on immigration reform, but children are the most vulnerable members of any culture.
Sharon Wiley is a minister at Chalice Unitarian Universalist Church in Escondido.
We really wanted to come down and show that there are calmer voices and cooler heads and higher values to consider with regard to the permit and the project.
Anyone can appeal the Planning Commission's decision on the shelter and have it brought before City Council. Wiley says that would be the appropriate forum to make the decision on what has become an issue of politics, not land use. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replegal.
Texas Governor Rick Perry says he's sending 1,000 Texas National Guard troops to the border in response to the influx of Central American migrants. Governor Perry says the troops are needed to protect against threats from Mexican drug cartels and other criminals. But the chairman of the Texas Border Sheriffs Coalition says it's an unnecessary move. For Fronteras, Travis Bubenik spoke with West Texas Jeff Davis County Sheriff Rick McIver about Perry's plan.
So first off, what's your take on this troop deployment? Is this the right way to handle this crisis?
I actually don't think it is. I don't think that it's necessary to, you know, infiltrate the area with a lot of troops. I think you put a lot of fear into people that live in the area. And I don't believe that it's their job and duty to do this.
Now, the head of the National Guard in Texas, Major General John F. Nichols, said yesterday this operation will cost about $12 million a month, and that is money that's going to be chipped in by the state of Texas, although Attorney General Greg Abbott has said he will seek to have the federal government reimburse that cost. Does that seem to you like a lot of money, and is this a smart way to spend that money?
Well, that's a tremendous amount of money with the position that we're in today with the unemployment that goes along in the country. And to spend that money to go down there for my clear definition is basically humanitarian aid because the Border Patrol doesn't have enough people to process all these people, but basically just maintain them, hold them, and wait until Border Patrol takes them in their hands.
So what would be an alternative approach, I guess, to dealing with this humanitarian crisis along the border from your perspective?
I haven't heard one thing about any local law enforcement. You know, I've talked to numerous sheriffs along the border, and there has not been any contact by any means with the person who is actually the chief law enforcement officer of the counties. I feel that it's a negative impact and negative direction that they're taking by not talking to the individual who represents the people.
Now, there have been tensions before between sheriffs and the State Department of Public Safety over the DPS border surge Perry launched last month. Some border sheriffs in your organization as well testified in Austin that they want more of a say in how these law enforcement surges are carried out, and they want to have a seat at the table. Has that happened?
No, to my knowledge, it has not happened. Absolutely nobody has called the office, and also speaking with others, sheriffs along the border, that dialogue has not taken place.
Do you think it will?
Well, I would hope it would, because of the representation that a sheriff has in each and every individual county. If the people are coming into their county, everybody could walk away, but the sheriff's still got to stay there, and he's got to answer the questions, why is this happening, or what are we going to do about it?
Now, I want to ask you quickly, we've heard from state leaders and Governor Rick Perry that these type of surges, National Guard, DPS, are needed because of threats from Mexican drug cartels that have been enhanced by this surge in unaccompanied minors and families crossing the border. Authorities have been distracted, essentially. But we've also heard that crime has, in fact, not increased because of this immigration surge. The police chief in McAllen testified in Austin that that was the case. You're in contact with local sheriffs along the border. What are they saying?
Exactly the same thing. There hasn't been a change of increase in violence. It's been pretty standard across the borders. But also the people that are coming, they're going and directly asking for help. I mean, they're not, you know, trying to break into places and doing all kind of crazy things like you hear. But they're going to get help. And there's not going to be a stoppage of any drug cartels. They're going to continue to traffic their drugs across the border. So there's not much of a change there, but not a great increase.
Jeff Davis County Sheriff Rick McIver, he's the current chairman of the Texas Border Sheriffs Coalition. We're talking about Governor Rick Perry's plan to send 1,000 Texas National Guard troops to the Texas-Mexico border to help deal with the immigration surge there we've seen in recent months. Sheriff, thanks again so much for coming in.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Now for another perspective on the planned increase of boots on the ground along the border. It's a fearsome prospect to some who feel Perry is merely politicizing the issue without offering much-needed aid to the thousands of young immigrants, many who are telling people here they fled for their lives. Frontera's commentator Yvette Benavides tells us about her life of crossing borders and checkpoints and offers this view.
At the I-35 checkpoint between Laredo and San Antonio, I turn off the car stereo playing Marco Antonio Solís's O Me Voy O Te Vas. I remove my sunglasses so the agents can see my eyes. I prompt my daughter in the back seat to put her shoes on and sit up tall. Answer him clearly when he asks you, I say to her. Okay, Mom, she replies, closing her book. And don't say okay, I tell her. And no, yeah. Say yes, just like that. I turn to my husband who's driving. And you, don't joke with him, I instruct. When the agent peers in, I feel myself transformed, my hair in two long black plaits, and my skin the caramelized pecan color of my forebears. Will he discern something in my accent? Will he look into my face and see some feature he's been trained to identify as alien, criminal, or illegal? He asks the same question I've heard my entire life. American citizen? I nod vigorously and squeak yes, as if I'm responding for the first time to a new language. When I was a kid, the I-35 checkpoint was on the outskirts of Laredo, and it was a fairly informal, low-tech operation. A couple uniformed agents leaned against their trailer office, nodded, and waved us through. Now, located 30 miles away from Laredo and the bridge to Mexico, the new checkpoint has expanded the border northward. Today, the checkpoint is a bustling, high-tech hive of fast-moving, eagle-eyed agents and packs of frenetic drug-sniffing dogs. Clusters of cameras line the multiple lanes designated for either cars or big rigs. A few months after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, I waited at O'Hare for a flight bound for San Antonio. A young, sleepy TSA worker pulled me out of the line of stressed-out, anxious travelers, frisked me, and performed a thorough autopsy on my carry-on. The last person to board the plane, I passed rows of passengers who looked at me with expressions of everything from sympathy to disdain. Disheveled and red-faced, I sank into my seat, swallowed hot tears of frustration, and convinced myself that I had to endure the embarrassment of being singled out. It was a sacrifice we all had to make for the sake of everyone's safety during that sad, sensitive time. I'm not sure that same justification applies to the governor's latest decision. While proponents of Perry's move to deploy the National Guardsmen say it will stem the growing incidence of crime, law enforcement on the border insists that the crime rate has not grown with the recent arrival of immigrants. I was born and raised in Laredo. From that border vantage point, I've experienced less invasive variations on that TSA theme of a dozen years ago for my entire life. In my childhood, at the U.S.-Mexico checkpoint, I crossed the bridge to and from Nuevo Laredo and declared to the man in the uniform that I'm an American citizen and smiled broadly to reveal my Mexican braces. Ironically enough, modern times have brought a very different anxiety-ridden reality to many of us. I can't help but think that the resistance from so many corners to offer aid to the Central American immigrants, the stinging lack of compassion and the horrific photos we've seen of gun-toting militia members promising their own brand of justice and protesters screaming at babies is about something else far more perplexing, frightening, and ugly to imagine. My family's been in South Texas for generations. I won't get into a playground one-upping of we were here first with anybody, but yes, we've been here all along. I suppose my people became Mexican-Americans or some riff off of Spanish Mexican-American Texans at some point around 1848 with the American conquest that usurped half of Mexico. Like Hispanic immigrants from other lands, we're a mosaic of skin tones and a symphony of accents, lexicons, and cadences. I couldn't mimic with any Henry Higgins acumen or accuracy what an acceptable immigrant sounds like. Any one of us would be hard-pressed to describe what an acceptable immigrant looks like or declare who deserves to be here. How will those sent by the governor, in an endless pursuit to identify people as targets, manage that? At the checkpoint, the agent asks the question three times, and we each respond affirmatively with a single word. My husband eases the car out of the lane and back onto the highway. My daughter kicks off her shoes and curls up again with her book. I turn up the music, and we head north, leaving the echoes of the Mexican poet in our wake.
That was commentator Yvette Benavides. You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. You can find the entire audio for this program and past Fronteras shows at tpr.org. Share these stories with your friends on social media. We have one-click buttons to Facebook and Twitter on our website. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.